foods. Ross says a goal such as losing weight can seem overwhelming. Focus on the daily steps to get there, diet and exercise, which are 100% within your control.
They also are much more accomplishable on a daily basis. So recommitting to behaviors that you have within your control is a really important strategy, not only for managing those resolutions, but also for thinking about combating those wintertime blues.
Ross also points to the Scandinavian concept of hygge, the art of cozy winter living. Sip your favorite warm beverage from a beautiful mug, read a book in a comfy chair, snuggle up with someone under a blanket by fire or candlelight, settle into activities that are slow, quiet, and still.
And what those Scandinavian countries tend to really focus on is, you know, embracing that and finding a way to celebrate that through comfort and coziness and connection to one another, just in a different way.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 17th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our producer and engineer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Mark Richardson, Eric Galatis, Alex Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philamath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kate Chase.
And I'm Sam Bowman. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. So we have talked a lot on this show about the Forest Service's proposed amendments to the Northwest Forest Plan, but now is really the time to start paying attention and get involved if you haven't already. The Northwest Forest Plan is one of the primary reasons that we have any forest left in the Northwest. Without it, and other protections that are also now at risk because of the Trump administration, our public lands would look no different than the industrial clear cuts and monocrop tree plantations that surround me in the Coast Range. In December, the Forest Service released its planned amendment to the Northwest Forest Plan in what is called a Draft Environmental Impact Statement, or DEIS, and we the public have until March 17th to submit comments on the proposal. We're going to release several episodes focusing on the good, the bad, and the interesting complexities of the Forest Service's proposed changes, and we will work to provide as much guidance and advice as possible for how to submit comments and get involved in other ways. You can find links to submit comments in the notes of the podcast version of this episode, and we'll also be sharing links to comment writing guides on our website and social media very soon. For now, I am so excited to start this mini-series off with Ryan Reed. Ryan is from the Karuk, Hoopa, and Yurok tribes in Northern California, an indigenous fire practitioner, wildland firefighter, co-founder of the Fire Generation Collaborative, a member of the Northwest Forest Plan Advisory Committee, and so many other things. Ryan is a thoughtful, dynamic speaker, and I've wanted to have him on Coast Range for a long time. Real quick before we get started, I always love to get feedback, questions, show ideas, or whatever else is on your mind. My email is michael@coastrange.org, and if you appreciate what we do, please share this show with people in your community. And just a quick note, this episode was recorded on Tuesday, February 4th, just in case anything crazy happens between then and when you're listening. Okay, Ryan Reed, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm so happy to be able to have you on and really set the stage, because I think what we're going to talk about today are the most important pieces of this Northwest Forest Plan. And I really want to dig into that. But I think it would be helpful to give listeners a little background on you as a person and the work that you do. So could you start with just a little bit about your background and who you are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, thanks for having me on, Michael, and Ayuki to everyone listening right now. My name is Ryan Reed. I'm Cut a Coop on Yurok, currently a master's student in forestry at UC Berkeley, and graduating this upcoming spring. I'm also co-founder and program director of Fire Gen, but most and foremost, you know, I pride myself and identify as a medicine person in the Cutty tribe. And so, you know, that kind of helps influence a lot of who I am, what I'm about, as well as contributes to the work that we'll be talking about here today. Yeah, in addition to that, you know, I come from the Klamath River Basin in the small town called Selms Bar. And so I grew up immersed in culture, grew up kind of being a part of different traditional practices that are very connected to the landscape as well as to my culture. And so grew up understanding the significance and importance of the landscape and what it benefits us and vice versa, and how we have a role in taking care of the landscape. It's always been framed to me as an inherent responsibility to the landscape. It's not you're not born with a right to the landscape. Even if you're indigenous, you kind of got to earn that right. And so I kind of hold that value very close to me in everything that I do, and always trying to leave the land as well as the world a little bit better from when I touched it. So that's a little bit of who I am. There's much more to talk about, especially within this topic. Very dense, very complex, and controversial subject. So I'm happy to, you know, get after it today.
Wonderful. Well, yeah, thank you for that. Just from hearing you talk, it seems like you really bring yourself to your work as well. So First, I want to ask you about your work with the Fire Gen Collaborative. That's a really exciting endeavor, and not something that every young person who's also pursuing a college degree and all of the other projects that you're doing would take on. So Could you talk about that collaborative, what its mission is, and why you decided to start that endeavor?
Yeah, absolutely. FireGen is kind of my baby, and so it's always great to kind of talk about how the growth that we've had in the past and moving forward. And so our mission and vision with FireGen is trying to empower and mobilize younger generations in fire, and whether that's fire policy, workforce, or just overall knowledge and education about it. And so it's really trying to fundamentally create a movement towards a better society that is more equipped, more adaptive, and more resilient to fire. And within all that is centering Indigenous leadership in the process. And so it's really for us is we're trying to fundamentally create a change, a shift within this paradigm right now, right? Whether it's resource extraction or fire suppression or the lack of connection to the landscape itself. But also trying to mend a lot, you know, it's a really an intersection of all these complicated issues and trying to create solutions for the future itself. And so as younger generations, you know, we're fundamentally not a part of decision making and moving forward. Why is that the case? Right. And I think that it's true for many generations since European contact that U.S. government has really put us in a paradox where we're really trying to find, you know, kick, scream, and scratch of how what we can do to get out of it. And so looking at younger generations is really important to one, undo some of the wrongs that have been done in the past and the continued uphold of white supremacy and various other hierarchical capitalistic demands are ingrained within the structure that is all powered, that's all circulated and focused within primarily white male dominated fields, right? And so we're trying to really work on undoing those various different things, right?
I actually think this is a great transition into the kinds of burning practices that you think are healthy on the landscape. But just real quick before I ask you about that, where can people learn more about FireGen? What's you all's website?
Yeah, so it's firegencollaborative.org. Pretty simple. If you just look up Fire Generation Collaborative, you'll find our website there too. And that has a good breakdown of the things that we did last year and all the projects that we're interested in too.
Great. And we'll have links to that and in our show notes and all of that. So
great.
Let's move on to, as a lot of people say, good fire.
Yeah.
So you describe yourself as a fire practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
First off, could you just talk to me about the experience of engaging in a cultural burn, especially as an Indigenous person? How does it mm-hmm. feel to help, you know, revive and reconnect to that practice and tradition?
Yeah, I think their cultural fire is a very special, spiritual, and important aspect on many different levels, right? I think it goes without being said that there's an ecological and social aspect that are critical, right? The need that the landscape, especially in my neck of the woods in the Klamath River Basin, depends on fire. And so it's our, again, as an inherent responsibility as Indigenous person, we need to put fire in the landscape, right? That's there's no question within our community, or it's our inherent right to be able to do so too. And so, you know, as so much colonial violence and erasure of cultural burning and what it means and what it needs to look like and how has been heavily lost, right? And so, you know, I'm thankful to be connected with folks within my family or within my community who have a really good idea from the very fundamentals to the philosophical aspect of the need for cultural fire or burning in general on the landscape. But I didn't grow up with the ability to know exactly what to do and what time, right? That's always a learning component for me. I grew up frustrated and just because of the fact that I live a shattered existence, meaning that I grew up knowing a little bit compared to what most people know, but I grew up understanding what we used to do, how we used to talk, how we used to be, but not knowing exactly how to do it or actually prohibited and restricted from doing it, right? And so you have this chip on your shoulder inherently as a kid who grew up understanding the significance, but the lack of practice of fire in the landscape. But the need for cultural burning is you're nourishing the landscape as well as yourself. You're reclaiming your identity. You're reclaiming yourself and what you're supposed to do here on earth. Just one burn at a time, right? And seeing what it does. And it doesn't have this very monolithic consistency throughout the burn. There's actually a lot of complexity. Some things burn, some things don't, and for whatever reason, right? And so I think that adds a little bit of uniqueness to, you know, there's a reflection aspect, right, of how we act and how we mimic those actions around us is who we are as people, right? And so, you know, cultural burning is necessary. It's necessary to be in the hands of Indigenous people. It's an important practice for healing. Right, to be able to heal a landscape is also you're healing your own psyche, your own mental, your own spiritual wellness. And so there's a sense of reciprocity is what I'm getting at. And mm-hmm. so, you know, there's so many fundamental aspects that broader society lacks, but cultural fire actually supplements. And so it's really trying to continue to strive towards that North Star of healing, because there's a lot that needs to be done.
So I don't want to get too wonky on this first point. So just really briefly, could you give listeners a quick sense of what the Federal Advisory Committee is as it relates to the Northwest Forest Plan Amendment? Because you were on that committee, I think, as the youngest member. And then we could talk about your role in that committee.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Federal Advisory Committee, which I've called the FAC, is just a group of diverse people with different responsibilities, different backgrounds and experiences to provide input for the Forest Service, right? And so mm-hmm. the Northwest Forest Plan created in 94 was pretty flawed. There's a lot of things that are messed up with it, right? And so our job was to advise the Forest Service to make very specific recommendations on given topics. So that's that role. And to kind of finish there is, mm-hmm. I am the youngest by, I think, 15 or 20 years or so, give or take. It's a unique position of mine, nevertheless, to be a young person in this position. So, yeah, and I'm super thankful for it.
Well, what were you hoping to accomplish through your participation in the FOC? And how well do you think that the Northwest Forest Plan DEIS, again, that is the proposed amendment that we're talking about, how do you think that that reflects the things that you were pushing for.
Yeah, there was no secret that my first objective or agenda item was to enhance tribal communities and tribal sovereignty. And so, and with that includes fire, right? The need the landscape has for fire goes beyond state borders or any of the sort, and even into ecological borders, right? And so there's such a diversity in the Pacific Northwest that fire has always been a part of it. And so trying to thread that needle. In addition to that is trying to be more than just representation, being more than just a seat at the table of a young person, indigenous person, wildland firefighter, or whatever role that I had, that I needed to speak my truth and needed to represent and not only represent, but also speak for those who could not speak, right? You know, my ancestors were killed and erased because of the fact that for just speaking what was necessary or what was need to be said. And now I'm in a position to where I don't have to live in that life anymore. And so with that being said, I'm gonna talk what needs to be talked about. And so really trying to underline as well as create solutions for the fundamental wrongs that have been done against tribal entities as well as other marginalized communities too.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of did they land that in the DIS, I think there's high agreement across the fact that there's high fidelity of our formal recommendations that we provided to them in July and what was coming out in the DIS. Though I think a lot of things have been left out, and it's probably because of the limitations of one, what the Forest Service has jurisdiction over, as well as what you know the Forest Service is looking to open up within the Northwest Forest Plan. And I think that the thing that they got back to me more explicit was the timeline. And not just within the fact, but also just consultation with communities and specifically tribes. Consultation by default is inadequate, as well as the time and effort that needs to be dedicated to something as profound and large as the Northwest Forest Plan. There wasn't enough time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's very skewed in that way. And there's so much opportunity and so many reasons why, you know, and that's a whole nother conversation, yeah. Right? Of why they didn't do certain things. But I think overall, you know, I think we did that the best that we could do within what we were given.
Yeah. Well, a couple potentially tricky questions.
I'm ready for it, Michael. I'm ready.
Awesome. I love that. So the Trump administration has been, I mean, it seems like their main obsession right now is with like DEI witch burning campaigns and trying to root out anyone who's or any initiative that doesn't put white men up at the top. So
yeah.
Because one of the main good things to come out of this process is that tribal inclusion piece.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the Trump administration is going to see that as some kind of DEI, you know, blah, blah, blah? And do you see any hurdles there?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, first off, you know, I don't see myself on either end of the spectrum of this political colonial aspect, right? I don't play into the binary very much or at all. I'm actually very pushed back on that concept. And so, but the Trump administration is honestly a different breed. You know, I think that having the different priorities that they have is unfathomable. It's very detrimental to so many different frontline communities, people of color, et cetera. And so there's definitely a huge hurdle fundamentally, right? I think whether it's because there's barriers to us operating as a federal advisory committee, there's barriers to the content that we have inside of the Northwest Forest Plan and trying to undo or trying to surface and elevate some of the voices and cultural erasure that is ingrained within policy, right? So there's a lot of that things that we might have to pivot or that might be, you know, fully, you know, cleaned out. And so there's a huge worry there that took a lot of discussion, that took a lot of negotiation across us as a fact, as well as the Forest Service, I'm sure. And so, you know, there's a huge worry there. It's a can of worms. And so it's kind of, we can go to that, but I'm not sure if that's the direction that we want to go here. But I think it goes without being said that there's a large worry and, you know, we're holding our breath right now of what kind of impacts that we're getting or what kind of direction we're going to get from the Forest Service based on, you know, their hierarchy and what leadership is telling them. So, you know, there's so much at play than what it started as of just, you know, Forest Service leadership and then thereafter or, you know, Vilsack when he was in the position. And so there's much more at play right now. And so there's so much uncertainty. And right now we're kind of just trying to continue to do our work and the best that we could in the space and time that we have to get it across the thing. And hopefully, which I think a lot of people disagree with is hopefully we're not a huge target and seeing if we can get it through. And so we know March 17th is the end of the public comment period, and then the final DIS will be coming out after. And so, you know, there's a lot of time for things to happen. And as you know, that things are happening by the day. So it's kind of a hurry up and wait aspect right now.
Yeah, it is absolutely day by day, week by week. And we'll be following this very closely, obviously. So another big question I have is, you know, I'm in the sort of broadly speaking non-native conservation environmental justice community. And I think that among our community, there is really genuine excitement about tribal inclusion, about more introducing fire and less relying on that kind of like, we can control and make war on fire suppression mentality. There's also a lot of increased logging that is some of it disguised as ecological, some of it just blatantly commercially motivated, that worries a lot of folks in the conservation community. And, you know, there is this widespread belief in that community, in that kind of non-native conservation world, that the Forest Service, whether intentionally or not, is binding together genuinely good and important policy reforms like that tribal inclusion, like prescribed and cultural burning measures, with what we would view as ecologically destructive measures like drastically increasing commercially motivated logging operations, including in wet, mature forests. So you can disagree with my framing, no problem, but otherwise, how would you think about those trade-offs, and and how would you respond to folks who feel like they're being forced to choose between allyship and protecting these ecosystems?
Yeah, I think that's funny, that last part, how they're tied together, right? And I do disagree with that framing.
Okay.
And you know, respectfully, obviously.
Oh yeah, please.
But I think that, when first off, I think that we're in a conundrum right now, that we haven't been able to manage national forests to the ability that they need to be because of the Northwest Forest Plan, right? And so, for example, how I say that is, you know, the Kudu tribe, for example, needs to get so many different levels of approval, permitting, et cetera, to be able to manage landscapes that they need to be managed to. And after a century of fire suppression, there are certain ecosystems that have been not touched, whether it's fuel build, a fuel yielding issue, or the fact that they've transformed into a whole different system because of the lack of fire, because of the lack of management, right? And so it's not as simple as that, right? I guess it's what I'm trying to get to, mm-hmm. right? And so there's a lot of barriers within, you know, limited operating periods or very critical habitat aspects that have limited the need for restoration, the need for anything to be done. And therefore, they're very vulnerable to climatic events as well as wildfires. And so we have this no action approach because of some of the various elements within the Northwest Forest Plan. Some people phrase it as preservation or conservation, but when a wildfire comes in and destroys these landscapes because of the lack of fire, because of the lack of sustainable management, then what is it, right? Oh, all right, well, we'll go to the next forest and figure it out. But for Indigenous peoples, we're place-based people. If our forests get razed, we don't have anything else to teach our next generations. We don't have the food. We don't have, you know, so as Indigenous people, we have no ability to step out of this issue. And most non-Indigenous, specifically white conservation folks, they are in it because they're passionate, because they have a specific personal tie to it, but not because their identity, not because of their spirituality, not because of their livelihood to the degree of health and mental physical wellness is at the state of risk the same way that Indigenous people are coming from, right? And so I think that's important for non-Indigenous people to really consider of, you know, what's being taken away from me and what has always been taken away from Indigenous communities, right? And so when we're thinking about allyship versus ecological, prioritization, for Indigenous people, there is no separation. right? There is no separation from the landscape and how we live our lives and our culture to the health and wellness of the ecosystems which we're prioritizing. And so that's why I always say we need to center Indigenous leadership, because there is no separating the environment from culture, from the social wellness of communities, et cetera. I guess I just ask listeners to really look at the depths of not only plant component language, which is very deep, very in the weeds of things, yeah, but also understanding there's a lot of nuance there, and that there's so many different, the best available science is really leading us in the direction that we went as a fact, as a Forest Service, and that there's more, and best available science means Indigenous science as well, just as much as Western science. And a lot of conservation groups only rely on Western science, which is inherently a colonial and Indigenous erasure facilitated group of knowledge, right?
The way you talk about the complexity is really the way I think about it. And I totally agree with you on, at least on the point of, this is not a one-size-fits-all situation. And
absolutely not, yeah.
The Northwest Forest Plan covers so many different ecotypes. You know, where I live in the Coast Range next to the Siuslaw National Forest is a very different forest ecotype than your homeland down in the Klamaths. Like, those are very different
exactly.
forests, different fire regimes, et cetera, et cetera. And I was just at a retreat for this Pacific Northwest Forest Climate Alliance that I'm a part of. And, you know, we were discussing these issues and somebody made the point that I think is really valid, that allyship is allyship when it's hard, not when it's easy. You know, when we all agree on everything, then that's not yep. really being an ally. That's just easy. Allyship yep. is when it's hard and we have to make sacrifices. And I actually don't even think about the right way forward as making sacrifices, but there are hard choices that need to be made, and we need to look at how we prioritize things a little differently than we have in the past.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate yeah. you. I'm sorry, did you want to continue?
Well, I think this one quick thing about that is, how often do you know, enviro groups or non, you know, Indigenous or white groups, including industry, look to Indigenous leadership, right? And I think learning more about tribal sovereignty and what the power that tribes actually have in fundamentally creating change could also be supported by allies as well, right? And so there's a path forward, and that's why I continue to say center Indigenous leadership within these different concepts.
You know, this is something that the broader conservation community, you know, I mean, there's definitely still folks in kind of the old school, but I know mm-hmm. that the folks that I work with are putting in a lot of work to figure out how we can be as supportive of these positive measures as possible while, you know, sticking to certain principles that we have around kind of what should be baseline protections, et cetera. And we're going to have those conversations on this show here over the next couple of weeks as well. For now, as we start to wrap up,
mm-hmm.
I want to know how listeners can learn more about your work, how people can learn more about cultural burning, and how you would recommend people get involved in this Northwest Forest Plan comment period, or however yeah. else you want to suggest folks get involved.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, first and foremost, there's so many great folks who are creating so much good work, whether it's in the academic space or within the tribal workforce space or what have you, right? I think that, you know, look to those. I think, you know, it's kind of just like your algorithm. Once you start searching up things, things will pop up and mm-hmm. things that I don't know. And so it's really trying to take, you know, develop the craft that a lot of these folks invest a lot of time in with the conservation topics or environmental topics. Do the same thing for tribes. Learn the history on the land that you're occupying. And so there's always a responsibility to learn more about it.
Mm.
For my work alone, you know, firegenerationcollaborative.org is really a good place to understand that. But also I'll be doing a little bit more work on the Northwest Forest Plan external from my you know, official role. Another aspect with the Northwest Forest Plan, yeah, the white paper that was created that you're referring to at the Just Futures Symposium that happened recently, that's a great first step. You know, shout out to the people who actually led that charge and created it and crafted it. There's a lot of great content, especially for non-Indigenous white folks who need to kind of express themselves about the things that they support or don't support, but also that doesn't get towards, you know, Indigenous erasure, which is a common thing within environmentalism. So that's a really great resource to help comment and make suggestions to the Forest Service formally.
Yeah, I read that paper, and we'll link to it in the show notes of this podcast. It's really helpful. I really encourage also people to check it out and incorporate that into the comments that you write. Ryan, you've been so generous with your time today. I really appreciate having this conversation. Is there anything that I've missed or that you want to make sure gets included?
Yeah, I know we're beyond over time, but I think one thing that you mentioned at the beginning of the show is, you know, how I bring myself into this work, you know, and I think it's important that that's a fundamental thing that I've been taught, especially from my Indigenous background, is that there is no escaping these issues because it's a part of my livelihood and it's a part of my future, and not just my future, but the future generations. And so it's really important to kind of have that genuine approach to it, because it has very genuine and very direct and personal impacts. And it's taxing, right? And so, you know, I guess this is kind of more speaking to some of the other Native leaders or people who are doing, you know, Native folks who are doing a lot of great work, is that it's a lot. You know, you're putting your emotions, you're putting yourself on your sleeves and telling the world, this is who I am, this is what I'm about. And that, you know, continue to put up that fight as much as you can, because I think everyone has a breaking point, and it's a hard thing to do day in and day out. And so it's something that hopefully folks don't take, you know, for granted, because it's something that is very, it's a lot on the psyche, and you're continuing to have to prove yourself to the world. And so acknowledgement as well is a huge shout out to the people who do that in the same way that I do, or what I try to do.
I think that's a beautiful note to leave this on. So Ryan Reed, thank you so much for all the work that you do, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Michael.
That is it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Once again, my email is michael@coastrange.org. Drop me a line anytime, and please share this show with all your friends, all your communities. You can find links to the resources that we discussed in the show notes of the podcast or at our website, coastrange.org. And you can also look up Ryan Reed at firegencollab.org. Thank you so much for listening to Coast Range Radio. We will be back with new episodes very soon.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio.